Station number 9354.
Honourable Lady Chichester, Reel 4. Did you have to get involved in any kinds of precautions where you worked?
Yes, somebody had to be on duty every single night for doing fire precautions because of the incendiary bombs. And there was a camp bed somewhere on the top floor of our office, which was a later private house. And I don't remember if I was alone or somebody else used to do it with me. But I think it was not perhaps as much as one night a week, but certainly one a fortnight, if not more. And we used to just have to sleep from the hours of darkness, or be in the building from the hours of darkness till the next day. And if there was a raid, you had to very much wander around with a torch and make quite sure that there was no incendiary bomb anywhere near. In fact, there never was in our building when I was there, so I never got involved in any drama of that kind, but of course a lot of people did, and you had your stirrup pump and buckets of water, and you learned how to use a stirrup pump and how to put out an incendiary bomb, but I never actually had to do it. I used to manage to get home to Beaulieu very nearly every weekend. Certain people drove down, seemed to have enough petrol to drive down, and I used to get lifts, or I used to go by train. And when you came off the train or bought a ticket, I think it was, into the area of the New Forest, and certainly where Beaulieu was, you had to have a residence permit to prove you had a right to be there. And if you didn't have a right to be there, they would quiz you why you were going and where you were going, and you had to very much explain who you were. And it's rather amazing when you think the whole of the invasion. There was no leakage to the enemy of information of what happened, and they were taken entirely by surprise. And I'm sure that the great precautions we took for secrecy over this huge area must have been the reason why it was such an enormous success. And I remember going down the weekend before D-Day, staying at home, and we all realised there was this terrific build-up of ships in the Solent. It was quite amazing. You could hardly believe that a big area like the Solent could be so packed with shipping. We all realised that invasion was imminent. Extraordinary, looking back at it, how the Germans didn't realise. And one rather exciting thing happened one weekend. In fact, I think it was that weekend. I had a boyfriend who was stationed at the aerodrome, and he said to me, if you come in your uniform, I'll take you up in a transport plane for fun. So you can imagine how pleased I was. And I arrived down in my Red Cross uniform, and we went up in a tiny little plane, which I think was called a Stimson plane. It's just small, one pilot and one passenger sort of plane. And we flew the whole way along the Solent shore, right along to, I suppose, roughly, probably, Calshot, and round in a circle and back. And you felt that if you dropped almost a stone out of the aeroplane, there were so many ships you'd have hit one. It was quite incredible. Stem to stern, moored, the whole of the Solent was shipping. And looking back on it now, I find it amazing to think that a young officer was allowed to go up in an aeroplane at that moment of the war with a girlfriend, flying right over the invasion fleet. It's quite extraordinary. I suppose he thought of some reason why he wanted to go. But it was an experience I shall never forget, seeing that mass of shipping just about to sail off on the D-Day expedition. And Leap House at the mouth of the Beaulieu River was the headquarters of J Force, the assault group J Force. So we had a lot of the really important planning of D-Day happened from the mouth of the Beaulieu River. And a section of the Mulberry Harbour, which was stayed across, was actually built in the Beaulieu River. I remember my sister came back. She was a Wren that weekend. And we were sitting having lunch in the dining room, and I can remember the telephone going. She was called to the telephone by her boss, and she was told she'd got to come back. And, of course, we realised that was another thing, quite obviously pointing to the fact it was about to happen. So instead of spending the whole weekend at home, she had to go back to Portsmouth. And then there was a most terrific storm, pouring storm. And, of course, we know now in history what happened, that they'd actually sailed the fleet that was coming from further north. And then Churchill and all the people in charge of this terrific invasion fleet had to take the big decision, and they cancelled it. And the ships that were on their way turned back. And then I think it was 2 days later, In my mother's diary, she puts Tuesday the 6th of June. She's probably right. She says that was the D-Day invasion. And by then, of course, I would have gone back to London. But my mother was at Bewley then. And I remember this amazing excitement to think that it lost, this great invasion that had been planned for so long had actually come about with the minimum of resistance in the first instance. Of course, later on, the Germans put up a big resistance, but in the first few days, we landed in a part of France they weren't really expecting us. And it was quite amazing how far they managed to get entrenched before the big German offensive came back on them.
You went back to London. Can you tell me what your social life was like, sir?
Well, my social life in London was absolutely wonderful, really, because all day we worked very hard, and as I've said, we had our duty nights when we were either in the tube station or fire duty. But all one's friends came back on leave and used to ring up and say, I'm back, will you come out to dinner tonight? Very often, only a day's notice or 2 days' notice or sometimes no notice at all. And we used to go out and dance. There was a wonderful nightclub called the 400 where we used to be able to eat as well as dance till the early hours of the morning. Looking back on it now, I can't think how I did it. I used to go out dancing, probably get to bed at about 4, and then I was back in my office, I think, at 9:30. I don't think we started till 9:30, but it was quite a short night quite often. And we really did have a very, very good time in between our work. People used to feel, I think, the sort of old story, eat, drink and be merry. It was a pretty anxious time for everyone. And I think when they were on leave, they made the best of it. And we really thoroughly enjoyed ourselves. In fact, I was, one night, I had got some lodgings. I'd moved my lodgings by then into a little lodging in Chelsea. And it wasn't very comfortable. It was a bed sitting room with a gas ring on the floor that I had to cook on, so all my cooking had to be done sitting on the ground because it had a very short cable, so I used to have to cook sitting down. And it had a gas ascot for the bath, and a tuppenny bath was my ordinary bath. And if I wanted to be very extravagant and have a rather deeper bath, I'd put in threepence. And the old lady who ran, who was my landlady, was called Mrs. Moneypenny, and she was a terribly mean old thing. And I remember occasionally I'd run out of matches to light the gas, and I'd go to her and say, please, Mrs. Moneypenny, could you just lend me a match to light the gas? And I really meant a match until I, tomorrow, can buy another box. And she never would give you a match. She used to come along with a match box, rattling, with never more than about 10 matches in, and then charge you for the whole price of a whole box of matches, which I always thought was very mean. It was probably only tuppence then, but I thought it was rather a mean thing to do. And I used to keep my milk out on the window ledge, which was all right in the cold weather, but when the sun came round during the day, it sometimes turned into cheese for the morning to go on my cereal, but I didn't really mind that. I quite liked sour milk. But it wasn't really very comfortable. And so when one got asked out, it was absolutely lovely. I used to occasionally have girlfriends in and cook on my little gas ring, but I don't think very often.
Was your work still voluntary work at this point?
No, I was paid £2.10 a week, which at that time was the lowest possible amount you could pay a secretary. And my mother, as far as I remember, used to pay my rent, which was wonderful. And I think I had £1 a week, £4 a month or something. I know I was very, very pushed for money. Luckily, there was a club, which again, I think my mother paid the subscription, called the Ladies' Carlton Club, which was extremely near my office. And they had a wonderful snack bar there, and I used to go along for my lunch. And if you had just soup and rolls, it was 9p. And if you had soup and rolls and cheese, I think it was 1 shilling. And then if you were very extravagant and had something rather more, it would be 1 and 6. But you could get a very good lunch for that sort of price. And then, of course, in the evening, practically always I was out. And I used to get lifts down most weekends. So I really did all right. I only had to buy my cereals and tea or whatever, or coffee or that sort of thing.
How were you affected by rationing of clothes and food?
Oh, yes, rationing. Well, now, we all had clothes rationing books with points in. And I can't quite remember, in fact, how it worked, except different garments had different amounts of points So if you bought a dress, you'd pay more rationing points than you would if you bought a shirt. And I know that was quite a problem. If you had anything like a wedding to plan, because I was married just after the war and there was still rationing, one of the things that people used to give you as a present was ration tickets or ration points. And I remember when I was married, one or two of the very sweet older people in Bewley put little ration, clothes rationing coupons, that's what they were called, in an envelope and gave it to me as a wedding present, which was very exciting. But food, we had 2 ounces of butter a week, and we had rationing for bacon and for sugar and jam. All those sort of things came out of our ration book. And then after the war, rationing suddenly became even worse. We suddenly had bread rationed, and during the war, bread was never rationed. But just after the war, the food rationing was even stricter than it was during the war. Our rationing of meat was very limited too. I can't remember the quantity. But you could get whale meat, which wasn't rationed. And if you bought it from a fishmonger, it was quite disgusting because it sort of picked up a fishy taste. But if you bought whale meat from a butcher, it had no fishy taste at all. It was quite strong, but not fishy. And I remember doing it with curry, which was delicious. You couldn't possibly tell that it was whale meat, especially if you didn't tell anyone. And then if you fried onions and put an awful lot of fried onions over the whale meat, you couldn't tell. I remember doing a stew with onions with whale meat. Nobody knew what it was. So people were really quite good at devising ways of doing things. And then from the chemist, you could get paraffin still, medicinal paraffin, and you could make very good pastry using medicinal paraffin instead of cooking fat. And that worked very well indeed. Also, eggs were very hard to get in London, and so a lovely present when I came back to London to anybody I wanted to do something nice would be to give them half a dozen eggs, and that was like gold to get fresh eggs. Living in the country, I was able to get them. But if you didn't get given fresh eggs, you used to have egg powder. And egg powder was all right in things like cakes, but making scrambled eggs out of this egg powder was really horrid. And I remember putting a little spoonful of dry mustard in when you made your scrambled egg out of egg powder, and that made it taste much nicer, but it wasn't ever very good. Another thing that was difficult to get was cereals, and I remember we used to, before bread was rationed, we used to chop up bread in little squares and dry it off in the oven with a little sugar sprinkled over it. And when it was really dry and hard and crisp, it made very good cereal. Another thing my mother used to do in the war was make enormous quantities of jam, which I used to help her. The government appointed the Women's Institute movement as jam makers, not just for themselves, but as jam makers for the nation, really. And they used to allocate to the Women's Institutes very large quantities of sugar. And then various people who were members of the WI used to volunteer to make jam. And because we had fruit in the garden and because we had the facilities, my mother and I remember used to make very, very large quantities of jam. I meant sort of 100 pounds at a time. And everybody used to lend their jam jars. And then it was all bottled with WI labels on. And I suppose it got taken off to some sort of depot. I didn't quite know what used to happen to it, but I knew that jam making was quite a big job in the summer.
You mentioned that you were married at the end, towards the end of the war. Can you
tell me? No, I was married after the war. I wasn't married until the beginning of 46, but I got engaged in 45. A few doors off from my office was the headquarters of the Welsh Guards, regimental headquarters, and I had had a great friend for many years down in Hampshire who told me that she'd got a cousin who was in the Welsh Guards, and I'd often seen his photograph when I'd been in their house, and I used to see this chap going in and out and knew who he was. I never spoke to him because we'd never met, but I knew who he was. And then one day I was asked out to dinner, and he was at the dinner party, and we got on very well because I knew his uncle and aunt and his cousin. And then on the way after dinner, he said, would I like him to take me home? I think we could still get taxis then. They weren't easy to get, but there were taxis around, and he took me home. And then he rang me up in the office and asked me out to a theatre. That was the second time we met. And then he rang up again and asked me out to dinner, and we went dancing in a lovely restaurant called Quaglino's. And then I was very smitten, very happy. And then he rang me up again or wrote me a note and said, would I come dancing about a week later? And he proposed that night, and it was only the fourth time we'd ever met. So I rang my mother up from Corbox, the little house where I was living, and told her the news. She was pretty amazed because she didn't even know I knew him. She'd never met him, although she knew his cousin. But anyway, that was in 1945. We were married in 46. The chap I got engaged to was doing this office job at the time because he'd been extremely badly wounded by a flying bomb in the war. He was organising some regimental sports when the regiment, the battalion, was stationed at Sandown Park, the race course, when a flying bomb fell, and people all round him, soldiers all round him, were killed and very badly wounded, and he was extremely badly hurt and lost a kidney and had shrapnel in his lungs and was in hospital for a very long time. And then when he got better and went back to duties, he went back to this office job as regimental adjutant, and that was when I met him.
Can you remember the actual ending of the war?
Well, I can remember the ending, and I can remember leading up to the end of the war. We suddenly realised, after the Allied forces had broken through and were marching towards Berlin, that it was only a matter of time. I can't remember the exact moment when we realised the war was over, but I can remember one or two things at that time. I remember one particular thing. The Allied forces had moved into some of these appalling concentration camps, and some of them had taken photographs which were sent very, very quickly back to England. And my boss in our office came to the other girl and me and said, "There's something I think you both should do in your lunch hour. I want you to go off to this particular place in Regent Street where there's a big room being used as a gallery, and they've got all the photographs blown up, enormous photographs, of what has just been found in the German concentration camps. And it's something so unbelievably horrifying. You won't believe it, but I think it's history, and I think everybody should go and see it. You see the horrors that have been happening." So she and I went off, don't say happily, but in our lunch hour to this exhibition. And we were absolutely shattered. We couldn't get it out of our minds. There were these enormous blown-up photographs of the piles of dead bodies, which of course now people have seen on television, but then it had just happened a week before, so you can imagine it was an immediate thing. It was happening now, it had just happened. Not only the dead bodies, but the people staggering around with no clothes on, like human skeletons, and the piles of clothes that were found by the incinerators where all the bodies had been burnt, and the whole horror of it was absolutely unbelievable. And I remember we both felt so shattered by this. I mean, you couldn't get it out of your mind. And when you realised that it was only a week ago that those people had been found by our forces, we'd realised that the war was coming to an end. And of course, the relief was absolutely vast. But still, casualty lists were coming, and still one heard about people being killed. Somebody I knew lost his eye. I didn't actually have any of my family killed in the last month or two of the war, but it was still very much going on, and the Germans were putting snipers in various places, so people were being picked off, even though there weren't the big battles in the last bit of the war that there had been earlier on. Anyway, it was all the most wonderful thing, as you can imagine, realising the end was coming. And when the final day came, which was called VE Day, Victory in Europe Day, because of course the Japanese war was still going on, there were the most amazing celebrations. And a cousin of mine and a couple of boyfriends, and we all went out to Piccadilly Circus, and the whole of Piccadilly Circus and the whole of Piccadilly was solid with people. And they somehow managed to produce flags and streamers and hooters, and all the cars were hooting, and everybody was singing, and a great deal of drink around. But I don't remember seeing, although there was a lot of drink around, I never remember sort of feeling frightened like one might nowadays in a drunken crowd. And then we all moved down in a seething mass, thousands of people outside Buckingham Palace, and we all stood outside, and some lights came on, which of course in itself was very, very exciting, because having had the blackout, we weren't used to seeing the lights come on. And everybody called and called and called, "We want the king, we want the king." And out onto the balcony came the King and Queen and waved, and everybody went absolutely hysterical. And I do remember that terrific thing of the excitement of that night. Then later on, VJ Day, I was down at Beaulieu. I can't remember the date, but it was in July sometime, I think. And that, of course, was very exciting too, but I wasn't in London that day. But we had this very big party up at the House in the Wood, which was the SOE headquarters. They gave us the most wonderful party that night. But somehow the VE Day was the thing I remember most. I suppose it affected one most, Europe being near, whereas the Far East being so far away, it perhaps didn't seem quite so immediate.
Did you continue with your Red Cross work?
Yes, I did continue. I can't remember what we did, but I expect there was quite a lot of tying up at the ends with the children, probably, you know, getting them back. And, of course, the training went on. And then I think when I got engaged, I think I just said, well, thank you very much, I think I'm leaving now. And I think I did. And somebody else, I expect, took my job. I can't actually remember exactly when I left.
How do you feel in retrospect, viewing the war years?
Well, it's interesting looking back, because obviously the very outstanding moments that one remembers and the very, very interesting times. But the first years of the war, there was an awful lot of life that went on really just the same. Day-to-day things happened. I remember going to people's weddings, I remember going to parties, I remember shopping. I remember shopping, of course, was a much bigger problem because of rationing. But there was a lot of the war, if you lived as I did, part of the war in the country, that was really ordinary everyday life. We were particularly interested, naturally, in the news and what was happening to our family, and also what was happening to my sisters and brother who were in Canada. But I think when you stop and think, an awful lot of the war, people were leading what one would almost call ordinary everyday lives.